Before we start, I'm Max Larkin. I'm sitting around Chris Ladin's kitchen table with the production team for Open Source.
3 weeks into our Patreon campaign, and we just want to say thanks and a few words here of why you should support us.
How would you describe it? Like, what is Open Source as a staff, as an institution?
It's an experiment in citizen journalism. What if we talked in our own voices a lot about a lot of different things? With the sense that maybe the public life of the society depends on it, you know?
Exactly. I mean, it's open source, and we call it that for a reason. I think a big part of it is I don't think we see a barrier between us and the audience, and it really is an open conversation.
So if you like the show and you want us to make more of it, visit us at patreon.com/radioopensource. That's patreon.com/radioopensource.
On with the show.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Susan Faludi made her name as an intrepid, best-selling reporter on the sex and gender revolutions since the 60s. Books like Backlash in the early 90s on the trials of feminism, then Stiffed on what was happening to men. Now comes the shock of a lifetime. Her deepest story, turns out, was hidden in her family darkroom, so to speak. Out of the blue came personal news, and now a stunning book. It began with an email. Subject line, changes.
I get this email in 2004 from my father saying, "Dear Susan, I have interesting news for you. I've decided that I was impersonating a macho, aggressive man I've never been inside." Signed from my parent, Stephanie.
Alongside the transformation of Olympic super jock Bruce Jenner to Caitlyn and the TV series Transparent, Susan Faludi's new book, In the Darkroom, marks a modern moment, a popular coming of age around old mysteries of male and female. Simple opposites, no more. Susan Faludi's father had changed his name and his nation as a young man long before he changed his sex. But there were constants, too, and contradictions. He had been a noisy father, but also remote. He'd been both reclusive and intrusive.
You know, a lot of people ask me, oh, was it hard to accept your father as a woman? And I was thinking, that was the easy part. The hard part was all the ways that my father hadn't changed.
Mm.
Because the father I knew growing up was somebody who was rather aggressive, autocratic, even violent at times. And his sort of despotism and his violence was the cause of my parents' divorce and of his, you know, leaving the family. And the cause of our estrangement. My father and I barely spoke to each other for a quarter century. And so then all of a sudden in 2004, he parachutes back in my life and says, "I am now Stephanie Faludi. I've gone to Thailand to have sex reassignment surgery." So after 25 years of not speaking to each other, a few months later, I flew to Hungary, and we began the long process of getting to know each other.
Here's Susan Faludi reading from her book. It's a bit about the tensions on her confined stays inside her father's safe house in Budapest. As her father, now female, slipped back into old manners and traits, Susan found her own way back to a child's voice.
I was slipping back into that 12-year-old self, timid and sullen, fearful of daddy, who was no longer daddy. Yet inside the ramparts, I'm referring to my father's house, my reclusive father seemed determined, even desperate, to come out of hiding, or to bring at least one aspect of herself out for inspection. That first week, she'd led me up and down the stairs, unlocking closets and cabinets, modeling outfits, donning makeup, and reciting labels. Max Factor English Rose Lip Gloss, Wet n Wild Coverall Stick, Vogue Self-Adhesive 100% European Hair Lashes, Trimmed and Feathered. She was introducing me to Steffi, as she preferred to style herself, displaying the evidence of what she called, quote, my new identity, including and especially the evidence of her new physique. The robe seemed always to be falling open, or the blouse, or the nightgown. Every morning she'd summon me to her room for wardrobe counsel. Do these shoes go with this purse? She'd ask, more often than not, standing in her underwear. What does it matter? I'd mutter to myself. We're not going anywhere. This is part of the return of the sullen adolescent that I used to be. Or she would barge into my room on some pretext. I think I left my stockings in here, to present her new body in a negligee. Her exhibitions felt more like invasions. She said she was, quote unquote, showing herself. But as the shows piled up, so did my distress. What lay behind the curtain of her new transparency?
Wonderful question. What lay behind the curtain of the new transparency?
Yes, that was my quest through so much of this, to try and find the other layers, because I think a central lesson in all this is that all of us are made up of multiple identities, and that it is not really possible to pick out one strand and let the others fall aside.
But isn't that a kernel, in a way, of the whole story, that inside the many identities and disguises and bodies, there is one strong impulse,
yes,
or something?
It's hard to know because my father, one of her lifelong traits was she was a bit of a trickster, and she's always sort of planning her next move. Her favorite phrase was getting away with it. She was always very proud with getting away with things. So when I would say, you know, is this something you felt since your earliest days? She would often say, well, no. Yes, maybe. Well, you have to say that. And then her trademark line was, well, I said it, but it's all so true in the Hungarian accent with those drawn out vowels. It's all so true. So it was always hard to know. But from what I was able to piece together, from talking to my relatives and just, you know, from finally getting my father to open up more over the years, I think the desire to be a woman was there from a very, very early age.
And he professed great happiness. She professed great happiness in that place.
Yes, she never regretted the surgery. You know, I think in the beginning, there was quite a desire to present as almost a caricature of a 1950s woman. But that abated over time as my father became more comfortable in her own skin and just didn't feel the need to prove it all the time.
He said to you, I wasn't in the proper role as a man. They can sense that now. Now as a woman, women like me more. I fit my role now better as a woman than when I was miscast in the wrong role. The best way, yes, he said, is not to change someone into someone else, but to put the person back as the person he was born to be. Now I'm completely like a woman. I'm just struck, though, that what we call identity, in his case, maybe all of ours, is something deeper than our gender, our sexuality, our era, our century, our accent, our nation. And in his case, it seems to have been.
You know, this goes to the whole question of what is identity?
Let's
right?
go there.
I mean, a sort of central question of my book was, is identity what we choose to be, or is it the very thing we can't escape? You know, it's like the nature-nurture question. The answer is both, right? I mean, for my father, there were all kinds of things that she wanted to be, that she chose, but there were deep, deep experiences and personality traits that needed to be dealt with. And I think this is true not just for my father, but for any of us on the vexed question of identity, where identity becomes a treacherous proposition is when it's used as a substitute for self-awareness, for grappling with the past, if you're dealing with your own history. Certainly my father's gender identity is an incredibly important part of who she who she was and what she had to come to terms with. But there were other parts of her life that were just as important. Her experience growing up as a Jewish teenage boy in Hungary, having to pass as a Christian during World War II, her disconnection from her family and uprootedness. Those all had to be contended with, I think, in terms of what's a healthy identity. Psychology, dealing with one's psychology is a crucial component to feeling grounded in your own existence.
You write a lot of yourself into this story, and you speak of identity, including your own, as a quality of resistance, a refusal to back down, a kind of counter.
Yes. You know, I had to ask myself, okay, what about my own identity? And what is, I mean, first of all, what does this mean? What does this mean to me as a daughter, as a feminist, as a journalist? And fundamentally, what do I mean when I'm talking about my own identity? And when I ask myself that question, I, you know, come up with, okay, I'm a feminist woman, and that's important to me, and that I identify as Jewish. And then I have to ask myself, okay, what do I mean by that? Because, you know, as a woman, I'm somebody who didn't follow the socially predictable markers. I got married very late and sort of on a whim, and I didn't have children. As anyone who knows me will tell you, I'm not much of a cook. You know, I don't bake, garden, or sew. So what do I mean by quote unquote woman, you know, or feminine? And on the Jewish question, I wasn't really raised Jewish. I mean, my father continued the pattern of quote-unquote passing. We didn't even belong to a synagogue. And in both cases, I concluded that where my strongest identification with these identities arose was in opposition to people who were telling me, you know, here's how women should behave. My sense of a woman came out of my resistance to the sort of sexist suppositions of the era I grew up in, you know, the early to late 60s, pre-feminism. And my Jewishness came out of a feeling of being an outsider in a largely Christian, mainly Catholic neighborhood, and also in observing my father so fearful of revealing his Jewish heritage.
You write, my Jewishness was bred of my father's silence, my womanhood bred of my mother's despair.
Yes.
Is that a general rule, you suppose, that we build our identities in resistance?
I mean, I think identity is a really complicated equation, and it's different for everyone. But certainly in my experience, my identity on those two fronts began with a sort of almost moral refusal to buy into the prevailing conventional tropes of my time. It's always been a very confused proposition. And over the years, scholars who've tried to nail down what it means have come away frustrated. And it's, you know, become a very sort of baggy term for self-actualization or, you know, finding yourself. I mean, it very quickly got hijacked into a sort of pop psychology buzzword. And then, of course, brought into the political arena with identity politics. We've been for at least 50 years in a period where people are seeking some way to root themselves, something to belong to, in a time where so many of the old forms of belonging are coming apart or unraveling, often for good.
But what, you know, in your father's story, that sort of cranky, noisy, not always pleasant self seemed to be much deeper than either his languages or his nations or his sexual presentation. I take that as a kind of general statement. This is something way deeper to the core than any of these things that we want to identify with or fix our identity around.
Mm. There's a deep need to have something to belong to. At the same time, that's not the whole of who we are. We're each of us incredibly psychologically complex characters with all kinds of forces shaping who we are, from what happened in the womb to our early childhoods to what class and race and geopolitical situation we were born into. That applied to my father as well as anyone else.
In your father's case, there's one unsort of resolved fascinating question. Is it possible that all his identity, restlessness and movement and change was driven and conditioned somehow by the Holocaust?
Well, yes and no. Yes, in that my father, imagine you're a teenage boy, which means there was a phrase for it in trouser inspections, the fear that you would, even if you had false identity papers, which my father had. And my father had a stolen armband with a fascist insignia on it. All it took, and this happened to many boys and men in the course of the war, was an order to pull down your pants and the game was up. And that traumatic experience of having to hide, a very essential part of who you were, infused everything else in my father's life. That said, I don't think there's a causal link by any means. Otherwise, there would be a lot of Holocaust survivors who would be seeking, or Holocaust surviving men who would be seeking sex reassignment surgery, which is certainly not the case. So, I don't think of the Holocaust as some switch that flipped my father's gender. But I think that these experiences were very much in conversation with each other, and certainly in conversation in my father's mind. She often would be talking about either her Holocaust experience or her trans experience and then would allude to the other one or would just suddenly, I thought we were talking about her experience being a woman and bang, it would be like a trap door opened and she would start talking about the war. And she also talked about, often with me, about how she felt her experience passing as a Christian during the war was something she could apply and did apply in passing as a woman.
Susan, he summoned you and wanted you to write his story. He thought you knew his story better than he did. But he wanted to call it the anxiety of non-belonging.
Yes, we were talking one day, and my father came up with that phrase and was very enamored of it and would say, oh, you should use that as the title for your book. But remarkably, my father did not dictate any of the approaches I should take.
And you didn't ask him to either.
No.
You were in a kind of battle with him all the way.
Between us, there was a larger battle there was a motif of a larger battle between me as a journalist and my father as a photographer, and a particular kind of photographer. My father did high-end commercial photographic development work. She did a lot of work in the 60s through the 80s for Condé Nast in what she called trick photography, basically altering images or just doing high-end, color conversions, creating a perfect copy from a print where the negative had been lost. She worked on...
This is Photoshop before...
Before we had Photoshop. The metaphors abound, masking, dodging. You can see how a journalist would be eating up these kind of metaphorical resonances of such work. She did work altering images and making montages for a number of leading fashion photographers, Richard Avedon, Scavullo, Irving Penn, Bert Stern. And she had a lifelong love. Once photoshopping came in, she was constantly manipulating and montaging and altering images. So that was her fascination, which on another level was all about, okay, I can erase the past. I can erase portions of this photograph that I don't want in the picture. And then here comes her journalist daughter saying, no, I want to restore the history. I want to dig it up and go through it all again.
See the original.
Yeah, so we were always on a struggle about that where I would say, okay, what happened in, 1944 and my father... her trademark line, oh, that's irrelevant. That's ancient history. That's what I was before then. And I was always saying no. I was always trying to establish a narrative, and she was eager to, sort of truncate that narrative and pick just the parts that she wanted.
Mm-hmm. But go back to what he meant by the anxiety of non-belonging as a kind of overarching story.
Yes. Well, I think it spoke to how my father deeply felt. I mean, growing up in Hungary during the interwar years, nobody who was Jewish felt they belonged. Well, one of many terrible tragedies of that period in Hungary is that for Hungarian Jews, there was a period in the last half of the 19th century up through World War I when Hungarian Jews did feel they belonged.
The golden age, you call
yeah,
it.
Yeah, this is not my term. This is the historian's term. It was this golden age of Hungarian Jewry where, for complicated reasons, the sort of Hungarian nobility, aristocracy, needed bourgeois Jews to help industrialize the country, modernize, and to be considered Hungarian or Magyar so that the quote-unquote true Hungarians could have a majority politically. So all this led to an immense opportunity for Hungarian Jews of, we're talking, you know, sort of upper middle class, upper class Jews, of which my grandparents and great-grandparents belonged. So here's my father, who, you know, in this extremely wealthy circumstances with my grandfather, you know, had all this inherited wealth from his father, and they owned luxury real estate in Budapest and went to their summer villa in the Buda Hills every year. And then came the war, and suddenly my father is starving alone, an urchin on the street, eating frozen pieces of horse meat. So to go back to the non-belonging question, you know, I mean, clearly my father didn't have a sense of belonging in Hungary. And then from that period on, wherever my father went, my father first moved to Denmark and then to Brazil and then in the mid-50s to New York. But there was never enough of a connection to make my father feel he belonged in any of these places. And then with the fall of communism, my father returned to Hungary and, just to make matters more complicated, embraced the idea. My father was always saying to me, I'm a 100% Hungarian patriot, and then became rather right-wing and voted for the current right-wing government twice. My father was always looking for something to belong to and often assuming an identity to belong to, whether that was swashbuckling, you know, documentary filmmaker and photographer in the Brazilian outback, or in the late 50s, early 60s, being the all-American, you know, suburban commuter dad with two kids and a dog and the white picket fence, literally, which my father built. So there was always, she was always looking for some place to root herself and never succeeded at that.
How did you leave it with your father? And how did he leave it with you?
You know, we always had a sort of fractious and sometimes contentious, sometimes very contentious relationship. But over time, we came to a deeper understanding of each other. And even a kind of forgiveness.
Dare I ask, love, do you think?
Yes, absolutely. In the later years, as my father was struggling with heart condition and then toward the very end with dementia, probably caused by the heart condition, a kind of vascular dementia, you know, our role shifted where I was really the parent to an increasingly fragile and in need of care child. Mm. And so, I mean, yes, there was reconciliation, there was forgiveness and affection and love.
Susan, we live in the age of the new Bruce Jenner of the series Transparent, not to mention the political campaign, and your book may go deeper than almost any of these stories in our world today. What are we learning, really, especially about the possibility that the binary is not it, that there's not only incredible complexity, but fluidity?
Yes. You know, here's where I think that trans theory, trans activism, and feminism come together. You know, there's been some talk recently about how, you know, some feminists are locked in battle with the transgender movement. And, you know, they're always people who are fighting with other people. But I don't want that to eclipse the larger reality that feminists and the trans folks I know, and certainly the new generation of trans activists, believe deeply in the same thing, which is gender is on a spectrum, that there are an infinite variety of gender expressions, and that to corral people into, you know, a straitjacketed notion of quote-unquote femininity or masculinity is deeply damaging and disfiguring.
Yeah. A Confucian scholar was quoting William James in a new book on the thought that you have as many selves as you have relationships. You are a different person in every one of them. Or you're not a different person, but you're a different outline. Meantime, you're writing about patriarchy as a kind of prison, which a lot of us guys can recognize. Speak about what's happening, and starting with your father, who, I mean, that bullying guy, the macho, super macho guy, was exactly what he was trying to get out of.
Yes. At times I wonder if the period my father went through when she was exhibiting this kind of extreme femininity, you know, lots of frills and high heels and that sort of thing, whether in a funny way that was her way of releasing herself from this extreme masculinity that she felt she had to display in the past. So it was sort of cracking apart this carapace of one false role by adopting another role that had to be sort of caricatured as well to counteract the other. And I mean, one hopeful or happy aspect of this story is that toward the end of her life, she seemed to find a place somewhere in the middle. I noticed that in the last few years of her life, you have to remember she had this operation at 76, so she was elderly throughout. She started talking about herself as being a trans instead of being a woman. And I think this speaks to the whole question of what does it mean to be transgender? How do you interpret that? Does it mean you're switching from one gender to another, which is, I think, how my father saw it originally? Or are you transcending all of that, you know, mishigas, and becoming a person who's not limited by labels? And my father was, I believe, moving toward that. Unfortunately, because she had the operation so late, she didn't have a whole lot of time to settle into that middle portion. I want to say also that a lot of the newer generation and the founding members of the new transgender scholarship embraced that very vision of what it means to be transgender. Susan Stryker, who is one of the founders of transgender studies, you know, talks about how, you know, we as transsexuals are something more and something other, which is a phrase I really love.
Susan, speak of the Hillary Clinton campaign as a sort of test. How central we put the identity question or her femaleness question, positive or negative, but a test of our own judgment of what's important.
I've written a fair amount about the intergenerational question, not only around Hillary, but in feminism in general, that going back to the 1920s, you know, wave after wave of feminism has had to struggle with the quote-unquote mother-daughter problem. I'm speaking metaphorically here.
But explain.
The younger generation of women have felt that their feminism is sort of based on rebelling against their elders, which, you know, is modern movements are at large based on that. I think the difference for women is that the mothers, the older generation, has not been able to hand down power to their daughters or to the next generation of women because they don't have it. And power resides still largely in a male establishment. And so if you want power or authority or a say over how the world's going to be shaped, there's this feeling that, well, I'm not going to get that from these older feminists. So I think that's one aspect of it. That said, as far as Hillary, I believe and I hope and pray that now that we're in the general election, the stakes are so high. I can't imagine that young women aren't going to rally around Hillary, because the alternative is too terrifying to behold.
We're still learning about Omar, the shooter in Orlando, but there seems to be a very plausible case that he wasn't doing this for ISIS. He was doing it out of a tortured struggle with his own gender identity.
And that's probably just one aspect of a very complicated stew of, I mean, he was clearly psychologically disaffected, probably disturbed young man.
But I mean, could you write that story? The man had been in the club a number of times before. He was drawn to gay apps. Others thought he was homosexual. Can you imagine the struggle inside that, besides sort of putting the whole ISIS attachment in the shade?
And also his economic situation. He had gone through, you know, something like 8 jobs in 4 years. You know, none of them jobs that held great meaning or would, you know, lead to any kind of creative expression. All these things go into the mix. But what struck me is on the identity question is that this was a moment that really highlighted this, how identity can be liberating in the case of LGBT rights, or can be frighteningly oppressive in the case of those who are defining their identity by demonizing another group. And that's so much of what ISIS and those who perpetrate homophobic or anti-feminist violence or anti-Semitic violence, it's all about, you know, finding another identity that they have to crush in order to build up their own.
Susan Faludi, thank you so much. Thank you for this book. Taught me a lot.
Thank you
In
so
the dark
much.
Room.
Thank you.
You're out of the woods, you're out of the dark, you're out of the night. Step into the sun, step into the light.
Susan Faludi's new book is In the Dark Room. You can find more information about it on our website. And don't forget, we're well into our once-in-a-very-long-time fundraiser, so please go to Patreon, that's patreon.com/radioopensource, and find out how you can help us. And thanks. Our show is produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, and Phil Gara. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.